This program is brought to you by PrideNZ.com.
I was brought up in Dunedin North, the north end of Dunedin, and opposite our place was the North Ground, which was a city block-sized training area, rugby and cricket and so forth. And in one corner of the North Ground was an old-fashioned men's loo, you know, concrete, no lights, no sanitation. Well, I was going to say no sanitation, but you know what I mean, a real old style. Anyway, I was always conscious of that as a boy, and it later became one of the places where I regularly, routinely, one might say, cruised. My first sexual awareness, or the time when I sort of came to puberty, was when I was about age 12. That would be the end of 1957, something like that. And I really had no sexual experience except one sort of fumbling with a boy at intermediate, which didn't really mean anything much, until the year that I was involved as a schoolboy in a French play. And it was during the downtime of that production that I became friendly with a guy who'd been at school a few years ahead of me, had my first adult sexual experience with him. And that was so great that it triggered a pattern. I'd come across a book called Minority that actually spelt out, you know, how you went about picking people up and and so forth. Anyway, might have come to the same conclusions anyway. But so for those, from that point on, so I'm saying fifth form, sixth form and so forth, I was cruising in Dunedin fairly steadily, especially on the North Ground. And by and large, they were anonymous, one-off experiences. But a couple of people who I met more than once. One was a very nice guy who subsequently got caught by the police and prosecuted and jailed, and another was a medical student who was in one of the university rugby teams, and he was, we're saying late autumn, early winter, he was practicing he was doing training on the North Ground, and I hung around, and it was obvious that I was, you know, we're talking about 9 o'clock at night in winter. I hung around, and he eventually came over and made contact with me. And he and I met, never knew his name, learned a wee bit about him, that he was doing medicine and stuff like that. But I went with him, I don't know, perhaps a dozen times through that winter. And that was a great, I have to say, that was a great pleasure to me. He was a hell of a nice guy, and we hit it off sexually, so that was good. There were other venues around Dunedin that I occasionally got to, but I didn't have a car, and wasn't the sort of thing you didn't go out around. I didn't go out at night on a bike. But there were other places that I stopped off at, and came to recognise one or two people.
When you say cruising, can you describe for me how you would cruise somebody at that time? We're talking the late 1950s. Mm-hmm. How you would figure out that this person was actually looking for sex, and how it all kind of worked?
Yeah. Well, the usual scene would be a public toilet at the urinals, and you know, if you were there to pee, then that was over in a relatively short period of time, and you zipped up and left. If you loitered, then and someone else was loitering, it became pretty obvious to each of you that the other was interested, or potentially interested, and sometimes it would involve, you know, leaving the toilet and then having a chat out on the street, a very careful chat, testing whether the other, you know, the other person was genuinely interested, and then finding somewhere nearby. I didn't have a car, but the other people I picked up usually did, or if it wasn't the North Ground, there was plenty of potential and, you know, posses around the North Ground where you could hide away for a few minutes. So it was that very testing the water, you know. These days people talk about gaydar. I don't think that really applied to me in those days, but the behaviour was, you know, behaviour on my part, the behaviour on the other person's part was pretty obvious to each other, even if ordinary members of the public might not have actually realised there was anything going on.
Because at this time it was still illegal.
And how?
Yeah.
And indeed, you had to be bloody careful that the person who appeared to be interested wasn't in fact a decoy cop, which certainly happened to me on one occasion and led to my arrest.
But at this stage, how old are you?
Oh, at this point? I'd be saying 1963, so I'm 62, 63, 18, 19, something like that. But quite steadily over those years, from about 16 on, 16, 17, 18, 19.
Could you spot a homosexual?
No, definitely not in those circumstances. I've thought about it later in terms of, you know, staff and colleagues or people in a public place. And if you're in, I feel that if I'm in reasonably long conversation with someone in a busy public setting, that I might well pick up hints from who they looked at and who they seemed to take an extra interest in, and I might think, oh, you know, he's just spotted someone coming in the door. Who's just come in the door? Oh, I see, that attractive young man. Oh, perhaps this is Ian's interest. You know, that sort of thing. But not in these circumstances. There was no opportunity to... I don't think I had any intuition. It was just once they started to behave in a reciprocal way to the way I was behaving.
So in the late 50s, did you ever pick up the wrong person? As in, you know, somebody that wanted to bash you or...?
No, certainly not at that time. I might have picked up the wrong person in that what they expected of me wasn't what I was comfortable with. That happened occasionally, but more often than not, we quite quickly established what the other person expected or was interested in doing, or indeed not doing. And I have been confronted in Christchurch in more recent years on two separate occasions by young men who were out to make trouble. I've had a knife pulled on me and I've had two watches stolen. But that's not even recent, that's, you know, 10 years ago or so.
So can you identify any other beats around Dunedin that were happening at that time?
No, they were mainly centred on public facilities at different parks. There was no sauna or anything of that sort at the time, and as far as I was aware, there was no club like the Dorian Society in Wellington or anything like that. The beach, the gardens, and then facilities on parks and training or sports grounds. I'm sure there was other things going on, but I wasn't party to them.
We say nowadays that people can live a completely open gay life, and that involves, you know, who you live with, how you live, and sex and stuff like that. Back then in the 50s, what did it mean to be gay?
Well, for me, it was just that major sense of difference. I wasn't then at the age when I would have been expecting Well, I suppose I was expected to have a girlfriend, and at high school, somewhat to my shame, I did in fact have a steady girlfriend. That didn't last beyond the end of high school. We went to all the dances. There was a small group of boys from Otago boys who had girlfriends from Otago girls, and we'd go to the school dances and to Bible class socials and things like that together. But I feel very sorry about it now, but you know, I would take my girlfriend home, and she would obviously be interested in getting a bit sort of intimate, and I'd be thinking, bloody hell, it's 12:30, if I don't get back down to George Street, I'm going to be too late. I say that with a sense of shame, really. And the relationship didn't really last. We just parted quite amicably. I think Jean realised that I wasn't really terribly interested in her, and I just felt that it was better to let it go. What else did it mean to be gay? Different, isolated, but careful. But it was a compartment of life. I still had ordinary friendships. I had my family and friends. Life was okay. Although being homosexual is a major component of one's life, it's not all of life. And there were plenty of other things happening in life.
Did you have gay friends?
None at all. Two guys who were at school with me, one my class at Otago Boys and one a year behind us, have since identified to me as gay. With the guy who was in my class, I'm really rather sorry that we didn't realise this about each other then. I don't think either of us were the obvious ones in the class, to be honest. I certainly didn't suspect him of being gay. And the other one, the guy who was 1 year behind, he had the nickname of Flowery, and he was quite camp and quite ostentatiously effeminate. And I didn't have any school contact with him, but I met him later on in Dunedin, and I've since been in touch with him, just by email.
And Flowery was a name given by other students?
Yeah. Mm.
What other names would they call people?
Homosexual, deviant, invert. Well, what would school kids call? Queer would be the main one in those days. Queer. Some of the more knowledgeable ones might talk about poo pushing or something like that, always just assuming that the only thing you were interested in was anal sex. Queer would be the main one. I keep, you know, this poofter came into use at one stage, and I remember David Longhi using the word poofter in some sort of public context and claiming later that he didn't actually know what it normally meant. I don't remember poofter from my school days, but certainly not long after, perhaps.
Can you recall at that time, were there any images in the media, on the radio, in newspapers, etc., that were obviously gay characters?
I'd say absolutely not. There may have been, after television came in, there might have been one or two of those sort of camp comedians, but at the time, no. And I've made quite a study of what you might call popular fiction with a gay theme. And until quite late, it was really doom and gloom and usually involved a suicide. And then there was a gradual change, and I've got one or two books from that very early period where there might have been a suicide, but the main character came out the other end, usually with a partner. And then one which was just written shortly after Stonewall in 1969. It was a very positive novel. And bit by bit after that, and then of course we started eventually to get perfectly ordinary gay characters in almost, you know, if it was American, there had to be at least one black character and one gay character. And some of the better English TV programs have quite, I think, quite reasonable, truthful and positive displays of gay characters.
The beats in Dunedin, the men that you actually met on the beats, could you describe them? Did they have any? Were there any similar features?
I think they were quite pleased to find a schoolboy. I mean, you know, I was a physically mature schoolboy, but nevertheless, I was a schoolboy. But by and large, in the North Ground, you got, you know, some sort of middle class intellectual types. All the people I went with were normal, sort of average males. You know, masculine looking, masculine acting, except in the sexual sense.
If you had been caught at that time, or if they had been caught at the time, what would have the consequences been?
If I'd been caught, certainly charged, that really would have been terrible. Socially terrible. Shame. That's just the shame of it. The embarrassment for family. But it didn't stop me taking the risk. You were extra careful if you thought that the person might be a police decoy. But I only once had trouble with the police in that period, and that was 1965, so I'm at varsity by then. And it was, I'd been in the capping concert that year, and I met a guy at the the capping function after that. And he had a car, nice new Ford Consul. And we got in the car and we drove way down Logan Park to find a discreet place. And I don't know why the cops thought we were suspicious, but they followed us. And because this was a long one-way, no-exit street, they caught up with us and challenged us. By then, we had swapped stories, and of course, by that time, we were able to say that we were guilty. We thought that they knew that we were underage drinkers, and they required the other guy to report with his driver's license. He didn't have his driver's license on him, and they required him to report the next day. But by then, you see, we'd swapped names. We were able to say we knew each other. I knew he was a law student. He knew what I was doing, and so forth. And we sort of had a plausible story that was a bit thin, but it was plausible. The drinking age must have been 21 then, and I was 20, coming up 21 later that year. But that was the story we built on.
And when the cops followed you down that road and they pulled you over, what kind of questions did they ask?
What are you doing? Why are you down here? This is a long way out of your normal way. Where are you going to? You know, who are you? Do you know each other? I mean, I'm sure they knew what we were up to.
Did they make any reference to...
No. And we came straight out with the story that we thought was underage drinking they were interested in.
So were the police doing a lot of decoy work in trying to get people?
I think so, yeah. I think that varied from time to time. I think what tended to happen was when you got a senior police officer who had a bit of a thing about it, he would put more resources into it. That's the general feeling I got. So I don't know how widespread it was. I do know that one, if not two, if not three police were operating in 1979 when I was arrested. I mean, that was definitely a decoy, agent provocateur type situation.
So in those early years, in the 50s and 60s in Dunedin, was there talk amongst the people on the beat about police entrapment or police picking people up?
Oh, yes, yes. Definitely. You would get people who said, you know, by the way, I've seen you here before, you just need to be careful, the guy in the blue voxel is a police officer, so just watch out. Yeah, that sort of thing. Or they might say, have you seen a guy about, you know, 5'10", with dark curly hair around? And you might say, I think I saw him last week. Well, watch out for him. I think he's a policeman. You know, I think he is a policeman. That sort of thing.
Could you spot them?
No, not really. No, they behave as one would expect someone you were interested to behave.
And where do you think they got, I suppose, the knowledge of how to behave from? I mean, were these, for instance, gay policemen?
Or? Well, I've always assumed that must have been, although in those days I think it would be more than your employment was worth for a police officer to identify as gay. Perhaps they got them from the same books I was reading.
Can you recall any media response if somebody was convicted of an indecency?
Basically, no great flurry of it, but they would publish the court news. They would identify you by name, and the charge and the sentence. If there was something a bit more sensational because of the person involved, there might be a bit more publicity. And if there was not so much people caught on the beat, but if there was something a bit more what they would think of as sinister, you know, choir master, choir boys, that sort of thing. Truth in particular used to do major articles on that.
And I'm just going to pick up, when I say indecency, that was the charge, wasn't it? When if you were charged, it was an indecent assault on a male.
Indecent assault on a male.
And that was even being sexually active with another male of the same age who was consenting.
Yeah. Absolutely.
It would still be indecency.
Yeah, it didn't matter what the age was. In the Crimes Act, because it was a crime, there was probably a difference if the other person was under 12. I don't think 16 was at issue then. Was for males and females, but not for... it wasn't until after law reform that 16 became the age of consent. Because, of course, before that, there was no age of consent because you couldn't consent to a crime.
So you moved from Dunedin to Wellington for a couple of years?
Yep.
When was that?
I moved to Wellington in 1971.
And what was the gay scene like in Wellington?
Didn't have much to do with it. I was living in an urban commune. David and I paired up with the guy who'd introduced me to David and his wife. So there were four of us living in Kilburn, and none of us kept personal money. Three of us were working, the three men were working, and the woman stayed at home and looked after the child, and we paid all our pay into one bank account, and we drew from it what we needed, or if it was a major item, by consultation with the whole group. Financially, it worked out well. In terms of relationships, it was catastrophic. and it eventually broke up. David moved out first, and then I found it impossible living apart from him, so I also moved out and joined him.
And David was somebody you met via the church?
No. David was the person that... I was introduced to by a fellow student at Selwyn College in Dunedin. This fellow student had said that he had a friend in Timaru who was very distressed because he was homosexual and didn't know what to do about it. And I said, well, so was I, and wasn't anything ready to help. So David and I met, and we courted for, I don't know, a few months, and then began a sexual relationship, and then started living together. And lived together on, more or less lived together from then till the time David died in 1995. But there was this brief period during that commune, just a week or two in those commune days, when David had moved out, and I remained in the commune.
So did you experience any gay lifestyle in Wellington?
Not really, although I was a member of the New Zealand Homosexual Law Reform Society. And there was one very brief period where David and I went to the Wakefield Street sauna. But that was about the limit of it, really. I mean, I was aware that there was the Dorian Society. I was quite active with the Homosexual Law Reform Society, but that was all terribly proper.
What was the Wakefield like?
This is pre-AIDS. Very a novelty as far as I was concerned. I'd never met anything like it. A lot of people, surprising freedom. Relatively easy to engage with someone who was attractive to you and who found you attractive. It wasn't a great success to go with your life partner, even though you both talked about it and were both open to the idea. Well, particularly if one of you did pick up someone and there was some sort of sexual engagement at the time and the other hadn't. You know, that not straightforward. We didn't persist with it, really.
I mean, was it quite well populated?
Yes.
It was a big scene.
Oh, yes, yeah. And as I say, very novel. I mean, I knew that such places existed in America, and I subsequently found out there were plenty of them in Australia, but it was pretty novel.
How did you get that information that they were in America and elsewhere?
Oh, through American gay magazines, basically. And in terms of Australia, I went to Australia on a training trip quite early in my administrative career, and visited saunas in both Melbourne and Sydney.
So how was getting publications, gay publications, into New Zealand? How was that?
Those more straightforward magazines like Advocate or The Village Voice and papers like that, not that The Village Voice was explicitly gay, but it carried a lot of gay advertisements and things, they were okay, but the customs were certainly down on anything that was pornography. I mean, stuff that you could pick up at the corner deli now was confiscated and you were in big trouble for trying to import it. I had a very complicated arrangement. I had a P.O. box at that in my early days in Christchurch, and we used to use a fictitious name and get publications sent to M.J. Ryan at P.O. Box 22718. And if you got a card from customs saying that they were holding an item addressed to M.J. Ryan, you wrote across the card not known at this address and just abandoned it. And if it got through, that was fine. You collected M.J. Ryan's mail. It seems hard to believe, because
were there many times where customs would pick that up?
Twice I had to abandon things that had been posted back to me, or that I had posted back from Australia, rather than try and bring them in through a suitcase.
But it's interesting that they would allow things like The Advocate, which would still be promoting homosexuality.
They seem to be fixed. Well, of course, they didn't like the more extreme fiction. For example, James Baldwin's Another Country was banned when it was first published, and then, this really intrigues me to this day, and then it was released in hardback, but the paperback was banned. So if you were a serious enough book collector and wealthy enough to pay for the hardback, you were probably trustworthy. But if you just wanted a popular 4 and 6 penny paperback, no. Can you believe it?
So, experiencing that stuff overseas, how did it impact on you when you came back to New Zealand and it was a bit more conservative?
Really, an acknowledgement of that. I don't think I ever thought of moving to Australia just because you could get, you know, sexier magazines, but you were conscious that New Zealand was a bit behind the times. You know, clearly the gay liberation movements were ahead in the States and in Australia. Not so much about the UK, but Australia and the States, definitely. But by then, the law reform movement and the early days of gay liberation and so forth was starting to make an impact here. And there was that feeling that it would come.
So what year was this?
Well, I mean, Stonewall was 69, but I'm talking about being in Australia in 1980. My first trip to Australia. So sort of about that time. And, you know, by then the Law Reform Society had been chugging away for quite some time. I joined the Law Reform Society in 1967, so, well, we're talking about 13 years or more before this period in Oz. And then by 85, we were in the thick of the Law Reform campaign. And I do think that, we're talking about publications and so forth, I do think that once homosexual activity was decriminalised, the argument that customs and censors used, that such publications had been promoting a crime, was no longer an argument they could use or wanted to use. And I think that, you know, the opening the reduction of censorship about gay issues started from about that point. As far as I can tell now, apart from major violence and bestiality and probably paedophilia, it's really open slather, I think. Certainly I've bought videos and CDs and magazines that would have been unheard of in the 60s or 70s.
I want to come back to the various homosexual law reform groups. But you mentioned earlier that you had been involved in a charge of indecency in the late 70s. Can you tell me about that?
Right. The charge was actually being a rogue and vagabond and loitering with intent. We didn't get as far as indecencies, but I was loitering with intent to commit a crime, which would have been indecent assault on a male. I was coming home late at night. It had been a hell of a day. I shouldn't have been cruising, but I did still in those days sort of occasionally pop in. There seemed to be a flurry of activity around the public conveniences in Manchester Street.
So we're in Christchurch?
We're in Christchurch, yeah. 1979. There'd been a couple of bashings there in recent times. Looked like a flurry of activity. And I thought, what's going on here? So I stopped and went in. There was a guy at the urinal, might have been two guys, can't remember exactly. But I was a bit suspicious and I left. Well, one of the guys left, I left, he went back in, and I went back in. And then I became suspicious. And I decided I need to get out of here and out of here fast. So I left and was confronted at the door by a third cop who subsequently arrested me for loitering with intent, being a rogue and a vagabond in a public place. They arrested me, took me to the police station, and at the police station, as they were taking my statement, one of the cops started really exaggerating what I had done. I hadn't, I hadn't done a thing other than going back in once, twice. And he started inventing stuff. And by then I'd sort of had my wits about me. I mean, I knew what you were supposed to do because I'd published the list of what you do if the police get you. And I thought, no, I'm not taking any more of this. So at that point, I declined to answer any further questions and said that I wanted my phone call. Who was I going to ring? Well, I said I was going to ring David Cagle, who was a lawyer. Was he an MP at that point? Anyway, he was a prominent politician, and he was chair of the Politic Council and so on. Whether I would have rung David... I've subsequently worked with David Cagle during the law reform campaign, so, I mean, there's nothing peculiar about that. The police said, oh, you wouldn't want your employers to know, would you? And I said, be no news to them. And indeed, subsequently, my boss offered a character reference. But, you know, I shouldn't have been there. I hadn't been completely honest with David about what little cruising I was still doing. And it was a matter of great distress to him, and subsequently, of course, to me. And we got over that, and we had our moments subsequently, but we got over that. But it wasn't a good time. Although, you know, there was no way, I wasn't going to be outed, but I still didn't want my name and the charge on the front page of the court news in the paper. And I knew I wouldn't be jailed, but I didn't really want to be convicted or fined. And as it happened, they subsequently dropped the charges. Now, it's interesting, one of the things I put in my statement of defence, was that I was openly gay, that my employers and family knew I was gay, and furthermore, that a senior police officer the year before had rung me at work to say, you know, forgive me if I'm wrong, but I understand that you are a prominent member of the gay community, to which I said, yes, I am. And he said, could you get this message out to the community that we want to know what was going on in the park on a particular night when someone had been badly assaulted. And we want you to get the message out that if people come forward to say that they were in the park that night and what they saw, we will treat that with complete discretion and there will be no consequences. Can you get that message out? To which I said, yes, I'll do what I can. So now that I was being done by the police, I was able to say, hey, there's nothing secret about this, and furthermore, I've cooperated with you guys before. But it was really, two things really annoyed me, that they were set up, they were decoys, and that when the story, as it was being put down on paper, didn't really add up to much, that one guy in particular started exaggerating. I was intrigued. He then disappeared. It was sort of almost good cop, bad cop, because the guy who then escorted me off the premises, dealt with bail and took me off the premises, apologised for the behaviour of his colleague. Sorry about my mate upstairs, he gets a bit carried away, or some phrase like that. But for the few months between being charged and being told that the charges were withdrawn, they were pretty tense, at home in particular.
What could have been the result of being charged with loitering and being a vagabond and a vagrant in a public place?
$500. And publicity. And again, you see, I mean, I wasn't ashamed of being gay, but I really didn't want this episode in the paper. For my sake, for David's sake, for my family's sake, I've been involved in things like the through rainbow-coloured glasses. I mean, my name and my bits of my story have appeared all over the place, so it's not an issue now. But at the time, although I was out, I was a bit embarrassed about the whole cruising thing.
Why do you think that the police were actively policing the toilets?
don't know what it was. I was always told that they only reacted if there'd been some complaints. Now, in terms of that particular venue, there had been some violence there earlier. So one could say that they were there legitimately, or sort of, you know, that it was within their range of duties. I don't think that warranted having a couple of decoys or embroidering the story. I've also been told that, you know, different times, different senior police officers, you know, put more energy and resource into it than others. Several of my friends have had brushes with the police of that sort. And as I've said to you, I've had a couple, the one in Dunedin years before, and then this one.
Do you have other examples of instances where gay men have maybe been targeted by either officials or people going to officials?
There was one example in Dunedin that affected me quite profoundly because I knew reasonably well one of the people who were involved. My friend had a relationship with a bisexual guy who at the time had a girlfriend as well as a boyfriend. The girlfriend, as I understand it, became jealous of the amount of time my friend and the boyfriend were spending together, and provided the police with information about where and when they would be together. The police raided the house, found them in bed together, arrested them, took them back to the police station and separated them, and told each of them that the other had confessed to what they'd been doing. Neither had, in fact. And as a consequence of that, my friend was convicted and required, may have been fined, I can't remember, but was required to undergo therapy at Ashburn Hall, the private psychiatric facility in Dunedin, and the bisexual boyfriend was expelled from the country. He was a Dutch national and was sent home. I thought that was pretty grim. I wasn't able to do much other than provide my friend with, you know, support and the offer of character reference and stuff like that. But that was pretty grim, really.
What year was that?
I was still in Dunedin, so it's before 1971.
And the only reason the police raided that house was because of homosexual activity?
I don't believe there was anything else involved. There was never any suggestion about, you know, drugs or... No, I mean, my friend was probably at varsity at that point and went on to teachers' college and became a very good teacher. And that was interesting in itself, that he declared this incident in his application for teachers' college, and the authorities, the teachers' college authorities at that point, were wise enough to know that someone who was caught in these circumstances with an adult was not necessarily a danger to school children. Not everyone would have drawn that conclusion at the time.
Just thinking along the lines of crime and impact, and I'm wondering, did things like the Charles Aberhart killing in Hagley Park and the Parker Hume murder in Christchurch, did they have any impact on you?
The Hagley Park murder certainly did. At the time, I mean, I was absolutely horrified that the courts reached the conclusion they did. Not long after that, a case of more of my sort of, you know, being a rogue and vagabond sort of thing. Anyway, a case came up before a stipendiary magistrate, as it was called then, would have been now called a district court judge. And he dismissed the charges. And I think the police appealed that and won on appeal. But that was the first time I recall hearing of a judge who said, oh, for goodness sake. It was a time when we were looking for any little shifts in public opinion, public behaviour.
All of that was happening around the mid-60s.
And a wee bit later, yeah.
Yeah. You said earlier that you joined the Homosexual Law Reform Society in 1967.
Yep.
Is that when it started, or...?
It can't have been going long. I think it might have been 1965. So I was starting to engage with law reform issues. And I became a regular pen pal with Jack Goodwin, who was the secretary of the Homosexual Law Reform Society at that stage. Stayed with him once or twice in Wellington. And he stayed with David and me here in Christchurch. And at that time, we got a wee bit of response, mainly from a Methodist minister in Dunedin North who also wanted to get involved in the move for change. So we had sort of a bit of letter writing and the occasional small-scale public meeting. Nothing very significant or well organised. And at that point I just started keeping track of everything that's happening in the law reform scene, writing the odd letter, petitioning Parliament, agonising over the Venn Young attempt and the Warren Freer attempt.
It must have been quite something if you were being involved with the Law Reform Society in the 65 to 67 and then having Stonewall in the US in 1969. When Stonewall happened, how did you respond? What did you think of that?
I was amazed, but I was the thing I was really intrigued by was the creation of Gay Liberation. Now, in the early days, Gay Liberation was reasonably well established in Christchurch by the time I got here in 1973. And because of my involvement in the Law Reform Society, which was in favour of law reform and would have accepted any move in the right direction, but the Gay Liberation Front from the start was repeal, equality in the law, nothing else. Now, in those early days, I'm talking early 70s, I took the view of the Homosexual Law Reform Society and decided that anything in the right direction would be worth it. By the end of the campaign, I was absolutely in favour of the Gay Liberation position. I mean, I thought it through and saw how things had developed, and I was bitterly disappointed that I was thrilled that we got the same age of consent as for heterosexuals. I thought that was brilliant, because previous to that we were talking about 21 and 18 and so on, and that was somehow a bargaining point, but if we could get 21 we would later be able to adjust it. No, Gay Liberation said no, repeal and nothing else, so that was good. And of course I was disappointed that the human rights bits were dropped in 85-86. So I was involved again later in 92-93 when we took that up and won the case there too.
Can you describe the difference in makeup of the Homosexual Law Reform Society as opposed to the people in Gay Liberation?
Homosexual Law Reform Society had a lot of heterosexuals. The society went for people, prominent public people, who had great mana in New Zealand society, professors and archbishops and people of that sort. Whereas Gay Liberation was either very much younger men, or occasionally had older men who were a bit eccentric. But the contrast was quite different. Law Reform Society, populated by gay men, but by and large very respectable, professional gay men with a bit of status and that sort of thing. And Gay Liberation was a lot of us who were quite different. There were some amazing characters, a lot of very attractive young men, and the older men were entertaining. Eccentric, but entertaining.
So would you get many people that were in both organisations?
I think that's probably the only one. No, there must have been more, but certainly. Because of that basic difference of opinion, people who'd come... You know, I got in early, before Gay Liberation was putting its ideas. And about that time, you know, Wolfenden Report, homosexual law reform in Britain, all very staid. I mean, in Britain it was 21 and you had to be in private, and if there was a third person present, you weren't in private and all that sort of thing, you know. But Gay Liberation just said, no, equality before the law.
And Gay Liberation, where did that come from?
Well, the key person here, as far as I was concerned, was Robin Duff, who, you know, may or may not be known to you. He's still very active in the gay scene and in teacher politics. He ran it here. I edited the magazine for a while, IQUIS it was called. And people from Gay Liberation became the key part, key people in the homosexual law reform group, the Christchurch Gay Task Force, I think it was called. Not necessarily the same people. For example, I don't remember Robin taking a large public part in the law reform movement. I'm sure he did a lot of work behind the scenes. But I became part of the little group that was really running the law reform campaign in Christchurch. I think I was called the legislative coordinator. I was expected to keep track of all these minor amendments that are being proposed and kicking them round and feeding back to Fran and co, Bill Logan, Fran, whoever, you know, what Christchurch thought about this or that. And we had strong associations then too with HUG, Heterosexuals Unafraid of Gays, a great movement, a lot of nice people in that. Some people in that I thought could have possibly been in Gay Liberation Front, but never mind.
In those early years, in the early 70s, how many people were involved in those organisations? How big were they?
I suppose the Gay Liberation Front, which I joined in, I don't know, 1974, 75, something like that. Well, an average meeting, a weekly meeting, perhaps 20 people. If there was a special function on, it might have been 30. The dancers, GUS, Gay University Students, I think it was, the GUS dancers at Ilam were quite big because they got a certain number of young straight people and, of course, more women than were involved in the law reform, though there were some good women involved in law reform. And just more people generally, people who wouldn't get involved politically would go to the dances.
And what about the wider gay community, the people that weren't involved in Gay Liberation and the Homosexual Law Reform Society? What did they make of the idea of changing the law? Was it something they wanted, or was it...
I think they were quite pleased when it happened, but they certainly didn't want it, nor did they think it was necessary. And they certainly weren't going to become politically active or identified publicly. They preferred, I've got to show my prejudice, they preferred to continue their piss-elegant socialising. Yeah, because it was quite, I mean, we were all aware of it, there was quite a social stratum of wealthier, older gay people in Christchurch who certainly were not going to be identified with homosexual law reform. And there were others who just weren't politically motivated, but who weren't opposed and so forth. And there were even some, God help us, who to cover the fact that they were gay, were actually toting the petition around. I've been asked to distribute this at work, and if I don't, people will think I'm gay, which I am, but I don't want them to know. Sad, but true. My only part with the petition which I'm sure I can't be prosecuted for now. I did steal a few pages from the odd church porch. If I found the petition in a church porch with lots of signatures on it, I, on two occasions, quietly removed it.
And this is the petition that was in the, was it 85, against the law reform.
Yeah. I mean, I found, you know, the fact that D.B. Lager and M. Mouse had also signed the petition. I thought that was a real hoot. I was very angry that groups such as the Salvation Army were toting it round old people's homes. I was angry that it was distributed at some Catholic schools. But anyway, you know, that's all in the past. And the petition was pretty easily sort of discredited.
So that was one kind of anti-reform action. I'm wondering, in the early days, in the 70s, what were some of the actions that were happening in Christchurch that you were involved in to actually promote law reform or liberation?
In the 70s? Not a lot. That really came to a head sort of 85, 86. There were gay liberation meetings. We were available as speakers for anyone who was interested, but again, that didn't really become a major focus of service group interests until law reform really started to be debated, 85. Gay liberation was mainly social, really, but social for people who were prepared to be politically active.
So was it hard to keep the energy up over the space of like at least 10 years?
Fairly. Yeah.
Did people think that law reform would ever happen?
I think most of us thought it would eventually. You know, by then things were starting to shift. There was the UK reform, which was not what we wanted subsequently, but anyway. And one or two Australian states had changed. There was a lot of debate in the United States. Some European states, such as Holland in particular, had moved in that direction. And they were all not Holland in particular, not dissimilar from New Zealand, a lot of Dutch people out there, you know. And so the fact that Holland had moved quite radically made a difference here. I think we thought that it would eventually happen.
So I'm wondering, did you notice a change in public attitudes towards homosexuality? You've got your gay liberation starting up, you've got the Homosexual Law Reform Society. Was there a change going on?
I think the change was going on. I think that's represented by the fact that that I was out at work in a major public institution. David and I both worked at Christchurch Technical Institute, as it was then known. We were known as a couple. We were invited to social functions, work-related social functions, together. We had a couple of lesbian friends who, you know, we tended to pair up with and go to such things with. But that, I don't know that the experience of someone on the factory floor would have been the same as that, if you know what I mean, or someone who was who was interested in rugby rather than religion, and you know, who was confronted with sort of locker room prejudice and that sort of thing. I never experienced any difficulty like that. The only thing I would say is that when David became profoundly ill with motor neurone disease, totally unrelated to being gay, there was a rumour went round Polytech that he had AIDS, and that was promptly scotched by our employer and by the union. But nevertheless, it was just sort of brouhaha'd around. Oh, David Pine, but David Pine's dying. He must have AIDS. It was assumed that any gay man who was terminally ill must have AIDS. Matter. It was soon dealt with, but dealt with by a really sympathetic union and employer. And indeed, I don't know whether it fits into this part of it, but it does in my mind. My employer gave me 8 months leave on pay with a company car to nurse David. Now, I had years of leave accumulated, so that wasn't an issue. David and I had worked there for many, many years, but nevertheless, and they applied a clause in the contract that allowed leave for family reasons. Now, it was intended to cover your child having flu and having to stay home, not 8 months to nurse a gay partner. And I thought that was pretty good.
It's interesting you're getting that acceptance, but I guess in the same breath we're looking at you getting charged in 1979.
Mm.
So obviously society wasn't all moving at the same speed.
No, and indeed the police, I think I may have mentioned, but the police said, you know, what do your employers make of this? To which I said, my employers know I'm gay. And subsequently John Hercus agreed to write me a character reference. My call was going to be to the chair of the Polytech Council. Yes, you're quite right. That's what I was saying. I didn't think of the police in particular, but, you know, the factory floor, I really don't know what it was like for people in other circumstances. We had really good liberal leadership at Christchurch Polytechnic. It was then called Christchurch Technical Institute, but, yeah.
So the first real big pushes towards homosexual law reform, when did that start kicking in Christchurch?
Individuals had been involved in the earlier attempts, and I was a bit disgusted when I learnt that some combination of the left wing had managed to scupper. I think it was particularly the Freer attempt. I didn't like that, even though, as I've admitted, I've come round to the gay liberation, but I think they were right, but I didn't like it at the time. But it really just, it was once Fran Wilde, you know, once the Labour government went in and Fran Wilde agreed to support the law reform, that it made a difference. One thing that I don't think people are terribly aware of outside the Law Reform Society committee was that Tirukartani Sullivan offered to promote a homosexual law reform initiative. And bearing in mind that by the time of her death she was a born-again Christian and signing everything she possibly could and opposing everything of that sort, it was quite extraordinary. I don't know how far down the track it got, but I was aware, it was probably while I was in Wellington, so somewhere early 70s, that she was willing to take that initiative.
Well, one thing we haven't talked about is the investment of energy from women in the whole law reform, and I was wondering if you had any thoughts on that.
Women in Christchurch, there were some good people who worked hard, but by and large it was seen as a male issue. I mean, the women were naturally horrified. One of the arguments was, when we started saying, you know, we want equality with women, lesbian acts are not a crime, male homosexual acts should not be a crime, some of the opponents said, well, that's easily resolved. It's not that we'll decriminalise men, we'll criminalise women. So, you know, that was a bit tricky. But women were heavily involved in the campaign for human rights in 92-93, so not all that long later. I'm not conscious, none of, some good women, of course, Fran leading the whole thing, but there were some good women, but they weren't at the organisational level in Christchurch.
Which is actually quite different from Wellington. I think there was a lot of women's energy in the Wellington area.
Yeah. And if you interviewed someone else, they may remember differently. There were a few women in HUG. And David and we had personal support from the lesbian friends that I was talking about, but they weren't out the front.
So what kind of actions were being undertaken in Christchurch to promote law reform?
Well, for my part, endless speaking to church groups and service clubs, and I've still got notes and records of the places I spoke to, you know, Kaiapoi JCs and so forth. Two or three of us would go. We agreed to, we had quite a little team, perhaps six of us, who could go out in pairs or twos or threes. So we did a lot of that. David and I were interviewed by The Star and appeared in an item which I've got over there, a big publication that was published in The Star, What It's Like to Be Gay. That was a bit of publicity. Endless meetings about strategy. One or two marches, though they weren't hugely subscribed, and we certainly suffered a bit of abuse as we marched down Manchester Street. And letter writing. Keeping track of which MPs were dickering, which MPs were opposed, and disrupting opponents' meetings. stuff like that. It was all on. It was very heady stuff.
So what was it like going to a church group and going to their meeting and talking to them about homosexuality?
That was okay, because by and large you were invited to a church by someone who was sympathetic to your cause. Now, that didn't mean the whole group was sympathetic to your cause, but the invitation had come from someone. So you got a bit of negative questioning, and you got the occasional person who got up and walked out. But it was okay, and the person I think of in particular that I went round with, he and I both had all the Bible stuff at our fingertips. It got a bit sort of silly and repetitive. Of course, the group you're speaking to doesn't know that you'd said the same thing the night before to another group. Pretty good sort of response. We did go to one Catholic-based meeting where a woman who was a pharmacist had an obsession about anal sex and went on and on about it. But eventually the person who was facilitating the meeting sort of shut it out. She wasn't being aggressively nasty, but I mean, what she was saying was just appalling. Anyway. So, of course, Catholic Church meetings, you see, by then we're talking AIDS and we're talking condoms and so forth, so there was this assumption that all we do is screw. Anyway.
And what about other meetings? I mean, did you go and talk to anti-reform meetings?
Didn't talk to. David Cadle was addressing one at a high school hall, and my friend Charles and I were determined to get in there and ask for equal time. And it sort of developed that they were going to call the police and have us removed. And David came out and persuaded us that it was better all round if we just quietly withdrew. So we abandoned that one. I think on another occasion the police were called and we were escorted off the premises. But we didn't resist. I mean, I wasn't in throwing myself on the ground and making them lug me away. But there was one at the Aranui High School where it really got out of hand. That was one where we were demanding equal time, and I had all my notes ready to tell them the facts of life about Christianity in the Bible. Anyway, but we ended up there just shouting abuse, equal time, and every time they tried to address the congregation audience, we just shouted them down, and eventually the police came and removed us.
How many pro-reform people would have been with you? doing something like that?
A big meeting, there'd probably be 20 of us, roughly.
Did you find it scary standing up in a meeting that's kind of really anti-you?
No. No. By then, you know, I'd had a number of years of being out and out homosexual. I knew that they were wrong. Arrogant, say, but I knew they were wrong, and I never feared for my safety at those meetings. I did perhaps in one of the marches, but and I just felt it was a bit embarrassing when I spotted. I was registrar at the time, registrar at the Polytech at the time. So I was technically the administrative manager, the line manager of all the non-teaching staff, and it was a bit disconcerting to see one of my employees or one of my line of management at the meeting as a member of the audience and congregation. And I had someone circulated the petition at the Polytech, and I saw it. I didn't try to remove it, but I saw it, and I saw that one person in particular, a nice woman who'd socialised quite a lot with David and me, had signed it. And I said to Roberta, "What the hell's this about? You know David and me, you like us, we socialise together. I didn't realise you felt like this about it." He said, "Oh no, you and David are wonderful, it's all the rest." And I subsequently discovered that she was the same about Maori. So every gay person she had met was lovely, and all the rest were bastards. What sort of thinking is that? But there you are, that was what happened.
And the street marches, you were saying they were quite intense?
Yeah, they were, because you didn't get a lot of people to them, and I think there were only one or two. But coming down Manchester Street, you know, you got stuff thrown at you and abuse hurled at you and so forth, but I survived. My experience of marches and opposition and police was in 85-86 was nothing compared with what it had been in 1981 over the Springbok tour. I mean, there you really did feel endangered. And also I was far more I behaved more radically then. I mean, you know, I was party to lying down at intersections and all that sort of thing.
Do you think if it hadn't been for something like the Springbok tour, we would have got the kind of protests that we did in law reform? Do you think that it was just the continuation of a change in
society? Well, I wondered about that, and I thought, oh, you know, this was our generation, we were the protesters. But then you see, you see film footage of waterfront workers during the strike, and really what we did and survived was nothing compared with what early union movement people had put up with.
Did you ever think that the homosexual law reform in 85-86 would not go through?
As far as I'm concerned, it was touch and go to the night it passed. And if it hadn't been again, it was George Gear.
I think.
Yes, I think you're right, yeah. Until George Gear changed sides, I thought it was lost by a vote or two. So, I mean, it was real jubilation. I mean, I thought we'd come back to it, as indeed we eventually did on the human rights issues. But you know, we'd put time and money in political sweat into the 85-86 campaign. I was very proud when it went through because, you know, it was relatively radical in terms of common age of consent and such a low age of consent. That was remarkable in the Western world, really. So I was very proud of that too. I sort of felt, once again, New Zealand was leading the way in social reform.
And it's quite interesting because on one hand you've got the kind of political campaign, but on the other hand you've also got the whole public campaign and getting people on side and saying, well, actually homosexuality is not necessarily such a evil.
Yeah. And although what was critical to law reform was the political campaign, where we largely took our lead from Wellington, but were invited to give feedback and so forth. So, and we certainly did a lot of letter writing and campaigning among local MPs to make sure they were on the right side and to try and convert them if they weren't. But for me, the public campaign was far more important, really. That, to me, was the real victory. The fact that, by and large, particularly once the human rights changes had been made, because once they'd been made, I mean, you really had a defence if your employer got snotty with you.
And that happened in, was it 1992?
It passed in 93. The campaign was sort of 92,
93. Mm. So, the homosexual law reform bill passed, or part one of it passed, part two didn't in 86. Mm. Can you recall the night that it passed?
Oh, yes.
And what were you doing?
I just socialising quietly. I wasn't at any of the big do's, listening to the radio. I suppose it was broadcasting Parliament. Elation, breaking out the champagne, and... yeah, not at that point thinking, oh, we've still got the other bit to deal with, but just really, for me, I was interested in law reform and in human rights, but that was decriminalisation that I had as the major goal at that point. And afterwards, just the general feeling that's that, we've won, that's good. New Zealand's now up there with the more enlightened Western countries, and this will make a lot of difference to generations to come. I think I've eventually... occasionally I feel a bit sad. I'm sure the unionists feel the same way, that the younger generation doesn't really appreciate what the fight was like for their freedom. Think that, but I'm just glad that they've got the freedom. But every now and then I think, oh, you know. But it's the same with everything, really, isn't it?
So, for you, did the law reform change the way you lived your life?
No, not really. Because although there'd been that experience in 79 and, you know, odd cases before and after that, really, by 85, 86, the police had stopped their activity. At least as far as I know, they had stopped their activity. And certainly by then, if there was violence in the park, for example, they would pursue that and robustly prosecute. The perpetrators. So things had started to shift. During the... at one stage, I was on a police gay community cooperative group that met from time to time and raised questions. I remember the main question we raised was with them was... the whole question of violence, domestic violence with same-sex couples, men and women, which there must have been something that triggered it, but that was a bit of an issue at the time, and we wanted to make sure that, you know, that they understood that same-sex relationships had the same dynamics and so on as straight ones, and that, you know, that they had an obligation to investigate those and support the victim, all that sort of thing. Mm.
So when you think now about kind of the younger generation and you see them with equality in a lot of areas, maybe not in all areas, do you have any reflections on...
I'm just glad that the law changed and that I was part of changing it, basically. Both bits of the law, by the way. I mean, both the decriminalisation and the human rights. Because the human rights, in practical terms, frankly, the human rights legislation is more important than the law reform. than the decriminalising. For the ordinary person, day by day. You know, but I now occasionally at the Polytech get a student who says, I'm gay, as far as I know, I'm the only gay in my class, and my tutor makes anti-gay remarks. And I expect CPIT to do something about that. And I say, we certainly will. You know, and got a section on sexual orientation written into the harassment policy, that sort of thing. Just that guy, the fact that he can sleep with his boyfriend doesn't actually make all that much difference. He probably slept with his boyfriend even if the law hadn't changed. But in class or at the institution or out in the bakery or whatever, makes a difference.